Even some of the older musicians took notice. Band leaders like Galloway, Edward Clam, and Henry Payton had already been making some innovative music when Bolden came up, but Buddy took the music in new directions. Buddy was the first to play blues for dancing, one fellow musician said, summing it up. Bolden was also one of the first New Orleans musicians to perform improvised solos, or rides. With all those notes he'd throw in and out of nowhere, another musician said, you never heard anything like it. But it was the younger musicians in particular who were picking up the new sound. Not just other cornetists, but clarinetists, trombone and bass players, drummers and guitarists, musicians like Freddie Keppard, Bunk Johnson, George Bakay, Pops Foster, Big Eye Louie Nelson, Willie Cornish, Frankie Doozan, even a young Creole pianist, something of an outsider among the uptowners, named Jelly Roll Morton. All were soon doing their own innovations, taking old tunes or making up new ones and stamping them with their own personalities. What exactly were they all playing? Critics would argue for decades about what the new music actually was. They traced its lineage to African, Caribbean, French, and/or Spanish roots, to ragtime, to various religious forms, and to secular traditions like the blues. But in a way, it was utterly new. Music created by largely untrained musicians without much experience in any formal tradition. That's where jazz came from the routine men, you understand. The men that didn't know nothing about music. They just make up their own ideas. Perhaps guitarist Danny Barker summed it up best. Who cared if you read music? You were free, free to take liberties, free to express yourself from deep inside. The public was clamoring for it. Many who heard him claimed that Bolden actually wasn't a very skilled player technically. He wasn't really a musician, trombonist Kid Ory once said of him. He didn't study. I mean, he was gifted, playing with effect, but no tone. He just played loud. But that loud, piercing horn helped him break the music free from the more reined-in style of his predecessors, bringing the soloist, that is himself, to the fore. And people began noticing, especially women. Bolden, an attractive, light brown-skinned boy, with reddish-black hair, a round face, and a sort of Maori look about him, was soon a local celebrity in Black Uptown, traveling around with a harem of female admirers who would fight one another to hold his hat, his coat, even his handkerchief, but never his cornet, which he allegedly didn't let out of his sight. And he appreciated the attention. Oh, he was crazy about women's, a friend would later say. One of those women's, an older neighbor named Hattie Oliver, even bore him a baby son before his 20th birthday. Buddy took care of both mother and child, at least for a while. Eventually, though, the new sound played by Bolden and his emulators became so popular among working-class audiences, both black and white, that it began to draw attention from some unwanted quarters as well. Police would show up at so-called cutting contests, where two bands would meet and try to outplay each other, and begin whipping heads to restore order. And eventually, the city's reformers began to take notice, and they did not like what they heard. To their ears, the new sound was dangerous, an affront to their notions of respectability, restraint, temperance, and civil order. This new black music represented excess and licentiousness, a direct flouting of traditional moral values. Perhaps most perniciously, it promoted contact, much of it of the most scandalous type, across the color line, and in a context of social equality that was simply intolerable to most Southern whites. Even before Bolden began to make his mark, reformers had already started protesting about the detrimental effects of so-called coon music. In 1890, the mascot had railed against a nigger band then playing in one of the city's more notorious venues. Here, male and female, black and yellow, and even white, meet on terms of equality and abandon themselves to the extreme limit of obscenity and lasciviousness. Soon, the Daily Picayune was also taking up arms against the new sound, calling it demoralizing and degrading, something wholly forced and unnatural. And now, with the rising popularity of Bolden and his peers, black music in New Orleans had taken an ominous new turn. Jazz, as one historian would later put it, represented the equivalent of musical miscegenation. In the context of the city's ongoing crusade for order, racial purity, and respectability, that meant it had to be suppressed. For black New Orleanians, particularly for those old enough to remember the days of Reconstruction, the last few years of the 19th century had seen some dismaying changes in the city. The New Orleans of their youth had been a relatively accommodating place for people of color. In the Louisiana of the early 1870s, black citizens could vote and serve on juries, schools were desegregated, and interracial marriage was legal. Blacks and whites rode on the same streetcars, frequented the same parks and lakeside beaches, and often lived side by side in the same neighborhoods. Of course, racial prejudice did exist, as it always had, in New Orleans, as in most places both north and south, and some of these freedoms were often denied in the day-to-day conduct of life. But, as one historian observed, for at least two decades after the war, many residents from the rank and file of both races played and worked together on amicable, harmonious, even equalitarian terms. In fact, New Orleans had had a long tradition of interracial fraternity, extending back to its French and Spanish days. Relatively liberal manumission laws under the old colonial slave codes, combined with substantial immigration from Haiti, Cuba, and Martinique, had given the pre-American city a large and often prosperous community of free people of color. They often intermarried with their white, French, and Spanish neighbors, giving rise to a significant population of mixed-race children and grandchildren. These so-called Creoles of color, most of them French-speaking Catholics, came to occupy a position in the city's social hierarchy somewhere between whites and their African-American slaves. Creoles of color often took up trades like cigar-making, carpentry, ironwork, and shoemaking. Some of them even owned slaves of their own. In the cosmopolitan atmosphere of 19th century New Orleans, social and sexual relations between these people of color and white New Orleanians were not unusual, even engendering a widely accepted system known as placage, in which a married white man would establish his mixed-race mistress in a separate household of her own. So-called quadroon balls, widely anticipated and often quite formal and luxurious, would bring these couples together, providing a context in which white men and young mixed-race women, and usually the women's mothers, could meet and come to mutually agreeable terms for a relationship. Such liaisons continued to occur well beyond the end of the Civil War, and were regarded, at least in some circles, as perfectly normal and acceptable. After emancipation, of course, a steady migration to New Orleans of rural ex-slaves complicated the racial dynamics of the city. The newly arrived African Americans, far less educated and predominantly Protestant and English-speaking, tended to cluster in uptown neighborhoods, while Creoles of color remained mostly in their old neighborhoods on the other downriver side of Canal Street. But although tensions and competition existed between the two groups, they often worked together for Reconstruction-era legislation granting rights to all people of color, whether black or mixed race, African American, or Afro-Creole. All of this had begun to change in the late 1870s, when the Compromise of 1876 brought the end of Reconstruction. With the removal of federal troops from the South, white redeemers had acted quickly to assert political control over New Orleans and the rest of Louisiana. A new state constitution in 1879 removed many of the equal rights provisions put in place right after the war. But even so, the redeemers, many of whom eventually wound up on the Committee of 50 that played such an important role in the Hennessy affair, were reluctant to do too much too soon. Fearing a return of federal military intervention, they did not begin to codify white supremacy, a term that in 19th century Louisiana carried no pejorative connotation among most whites, for some time, even as late as 1884-85, when New Orleans hosted the World's Industrial and Cotton Centennial Exposition, interracial contact was still relatively free. One prominent visitor of the day, writer Charles Dudley Warner, was pleasantly surprised by what he saw at the fair. "White and colored people mingled freely," he reported. "On Louisiana Day, the colored citizens took their full share of the parade and honors. Their societies marched with the others, and the races mingled on the grounds in unconscious equality of privileges." But starting in 1890, just around the time that Mayor Shakespeare and his allies had begun their campaign against the Italian underworld, Louisiana whites decided it was time to reassert old racial hierarchies as well. And in this task, the white elites had the full support of the white working class, now feeling the pinch of job competition from black workers. New steps were taken to assert an inviolable color line in everyday life, and at the same time to systematically erase the middle caste distinction enjoyed by the city's Creoles of color. The most ominous of these efforts was a movement to institute a railroad segregation law. Naturally, political opposition to the proposed measure, Section 2 of the 1890 Louisiana Legislature's Act 3, was fierce. But by the summer of 1890, Act 3 had been passed by the legislature, becoming the state's first official Jim Crow law. Unfortunately, it would not be the last. The story of how this pernicious new law was tested by a young man named Homer Plessy, a light-skinned Creole from the Faubourg Tremé, is well known. Less well known is the fact that Plessy's arrest on June 7, 1892, was entirely orchestrated by an organization of well-heeled Creoles of color known as the Comité des Citoyens. Even the train conductor and arresting policemen were in on the plot, calmly apprehending the young shoemaker when he refused to leave the whites-only carriage of an East Louisiana railroad train. But although Plessy's court challenge would take years to work its way to the Supreme Court, the onslaught of Jim Crow in Louisiana just continued. Over the next few years, other new laws were passed to suppress the status and freedom of the state's black population. Interracial marriage was banned again, and even interracial boxing was prohibited, after a match in which a black featherweight fighter convincingly dismantled his white opponent in the ring. Worst of all, a movement arose for yet another new state constitution, the effect of which would be to deprive virtually all of the state's black residents of their right to vote. And when Plessy v. Ferguson was finally decided by the Supreme Court in 1896, it was yet another blow. The court upheld the Separate Car Act, institutionalizing the concept of separate but equal accommodations for whites and blacks, both African American and Creole, for decades to come. Jim Crow had arrived in Louisiana to stay. And now, in the late 90s, the self-styled forces of white supremacy began to target yet another arena of black aspiration, the new music being played by Buddy Bolden and the other proto-jazzmen. For many whites in the city, the music challenged the spirit of Jim Crow in a literal way, by bringing white and black audiences together, but also symbolically as well. Jazz was, in a very real sense, an expression of defiance, a projection of black male power that rebelled against the increasing efforts to marginalize and suppress the race. As such, it was viewed as a threat not just to respectability, but to the entire social order that was being reasserted in the post-Reconstruction South. Even so, an organized effort to quash this less tangible form of black self-assertion would come only gradually over the next years. In the meantime, there were just sporadic and unorganized acts of intimidation. A band at a Negro fish fry broken up here, a racially mixed street concert raided by police there. In 1896, during one of the city's occasional smallpox epidemics, an effort would be made to close the notorious Negro Dives of Franklin Street, ostensibly for health reasons. The effort did not succeed. But with the opening of the two Storyvilles in 1898, it was hoped that the black jazz culture could similarly be segregated and contained, moved out of the sight of respectable New Orleanians. In this first phase of the city's war of reform, all that was disrespectable and disruptive, if it could not be stamped out, would at least be kept within boundaries. But jazz, like prostitution, would not be so easy to control. A few months after the opening of Storyville, after the start of the Spanish-American War, Buddy Bolden and his band were playing at the wharf at the end of St. Louis Street, sending off a Negro regiment bound for Cuba. The band was playing Home Sweet Home, in their own expressive way, as the ship moved away from the dock. But then, many of the soldiers on board, overcome by a nostalgia evoked by the music, began jumping off the ship with their own musical instruments and swimming back to shore. "I'm telling you, that was it," one musician said, recalling the incident. "Over the side the boys went. They just couldn't take it. We had banjos and violins floating on that river for a week. Of course, this story may be at least partly apocryphal, but it hints at the power of Bolden's music as the kind of disruptive force unwelcome to the city's powers that be. In fact, according to some reports, military bands in New Orleans were forever after forbidden to play Home Sweet Home, in a jazzy style or otherwise. The song's message, after all, was hardly conducive to persuading men to go off and be killed for their country. But in those final years of the 19th century, another young black man, somewhat older than Bolden, had come to New Orleans with some subversive new ideas of his own. He was not a loud and flashy musician. Most who knew him even described him as quiet, scholarly, and unassuming. But Robert Charles, a former railroad maintenance worker from Mississippi, was not one to passively accept the city's new racial strictures without a fight. And he was soon to challenge the city's white establishment in a much more overt way, with an act of defiance that would end up altering the racial dynamics of the Crescent City for many years to come. Chapter 7. Desperado. On a dark, tropical Monday evening in July of 1900, two black men sat quietly on the front steps of a house on Dryad Street in uptown New Orleans. It was nearly 11 o'clock, and they had been waiting there for some time. The two were hoping to visit some female friends who lived down the block, but since the friends were renting the back room of a white woman's house, they all had to be somewhat discreet. The landlady would certainly not allow a late-night visit, especially not by two black suitors of her tenants. So the men were biding their time, waiting for the lights to go out in the front room of the house. The two men, Robert Charles, 34 years old, and his much younger friend, Leonard Pierce, were roommates, living in a single room of a cottage on 4th Street, just a few blocks away. They had known each other for years, and in fact may have been cousins, though it was only recently that they had moved in together. Charles had just lost his job at a lumber yard the month before, and after moving around for a while to ever cheaper lodgings, he had eventually convinced his friend to share the room on 4th so that they could split their living expenses. Pierce, also unemployed, had been more than willing to agree, eager to vacate the house where he had lived with his now separated parents. Besides, Charles was an agreeable roommate, very easy to get along with. Intelligent and bookish, he carried himself with an air of elegance, accentuated by his well-tailored clothes and ever-present black bowler hat. But although Charles seemed peaceable enough to most people who knew him, some friends noted an underlying resentment beneath his surface good nature. The plight of the black man in the New Orleans of 1900 did not sit well with Robert Charles, and he had become increasingly angry at the growing injustices he saw all around him. Certainly, he had concrete reasons for feeling resentful. No black man in that era was a stranger to intimidation and bigotry, but Charles had seen more than his share. Born just after the Civil War into a family of sharecroppers in rural Pine Bluff, Mississippi, he had witnessed firsthand the violent reassertion of white supremacy that had followed the collapse of Reconstruction in the South. During the 1883 elections in his native Copiah County, young Robert and his family had been forced to flee their home and hide in the woods for days on end to avoid marauding gangs of whites determined to control the election by terrorizing any blacks who might have the audacity to try to vote. One African-American church was burned to the ground, and numerous black leaders were dragged from their homes and threatened with lynching if they dared to intervene. After that fraudulent and violent election, many demoralized blacks migrated out of Copiah County, and Robert Charles was one of them. He moved to Vicksburg, some 30 miles away, and found employment on the Louisville, New Orleans, and Texas Railroad. But things didn't go well for him there either. In May of 1892, during a dispute about a stolen pistol, Charles got involved in a shootout with a white railroad flagman. No one was hurt in the incident, but by then Charles knew that a black man could not shoot a gun at a white man without dire consequences in Mississippi, no matter what the provocation. And so he became something of a fugitive, traveling around the state for months under the alias Curtis Robinson. By late 1894, he had found his way to New Orleans. Still living under his assumed name, he worked on and off as a manual laborer and a seasonal contractor, hiring black New Orleanians to work as extra hands on sugar plantations outside the city. He also earned some money distributing literature for the International Migration Society, an organization for American blacks who wanted to migrate to Africa. Charles had joined the society in May of 1896 and had even paid a deposit on a voyage to Liberia for himself. What caused the 30-year-old to contemplate such a drastic step is not known for sure, but it likely had to do with the evolving racial attitudes in New Orleans in the 1890s. Having escaped the malignant bigotry of the rural Mississippi of his childhood, he had arrived in the Crescent City just at the time when it was playing catch-up with the rest of the South on issues of white supremacy. By the late 90s, as Homer Plessy, Buddy Bolden, and every other black New Orleanian could attest, Jim Crow was making the formerly tolerant city far more similar to the rigidly segregated cities in the rest of the South. And the timing of Charles's application to the Migration Society was especially significant, having come just 1 month after the Louisiana election of April 1896, an election that had brought race relations in New Orleans to a new low. It was then that he began distributing migration literature and making plans for his escape to Liberia. It was also then that he began carrying a concealed pistol in his pocket whenever he left his home. And that pistol was with him now, as he and Leonard Pierce sat on the steps of the Dryad's house on the night of July 23, 1900, waiting for that light to go out. But their presence in the neighborhood had not gone unnoticed. Police Sergeant Jules C. O'Coin was making his nightly rounds when, at about 11 p.m., a passerby told him of two suspicious-looking Negroes sitting in front of a house on the next block. O'Coin gathered up two more patrolmen, August T. Mora and Joseph D. Cantrell, and enlisted them to help him investigate. They found Charles and Pierce on the steps of 2815 Dryads and demanded to know what they were doing there. According to later testimony by Patrolman Mora, the men gave a vague answer about waiting for a friend. Then Charles, for whatever reason, stood up. Mora apparently interpreted this as an aggressive move. "I grabbed him," the patrolman said. "The Negro pulled, but I held fast, and he finally pulled me into the street. Here I began using my billet, and the Negro jerked from my grasp and ran." Mora seemed confused about exactly what happened next. In one interview, he claimed that Charles pulled out his pistol first. In later testimony, he said that he himself was the first to draw his gun. Either way, the two were soon shooting at each other, with Patrolman Cantrell also taking several shots at the retreating black man. It was over very quickly. Charles, who had been hit in the thigh, was nonetheless able to sprint down the street with Cantrell on his heels. Mora lay in the street, bleeding from a wound to the hip. Leonard Pierce, meanwhile, sat frozen on the steps, staring at O'Coin's big Colt revolver aimed straight at his head. One of the most violent weeks in New Orleans history had just begun. An hour later, Leonard Pierce was sitting in the 6th Precinct Station charged with shooting at Sergeant O'Coin. The charge was bogus, of course. Even O'Coin himself denied it, but it was intended to frighten the terrified youth into telling what he knew about the man who did shoot at the police. And Pierce was forthcoming, to a degree. He told Captain John T. Day that his companion was named Robinson. He knew Charles's real name, but chose to reveal only his alias, and that he was from Mississippi. Pierce claimed to know little more about him other than that. Captain Day had in the meantime assigned several patrolmen to return to the scene and try to follow the trail of blood from the wounded man's leg. This, however, proved fruitless. The trail petered out after a few hundred feet, and the patrolmen eventually had to return to the station empty-handed. But by then, Captain Day had learned the assailant's real name and home address, either from Pierce or by some other means. When he met the search party at the door of the station, he was smiling. "I know where I can get that nigger now," he said. The captain's instinct was right. Charles, after shrewdly running in the opposite direction from his home for a few blocks, had doubled back and headed toward his room at the 4th Street cottage. Once there, he had wrapped his leg wound in green gauze and armed himself with a 38 caliber Winchester rifle that he'd borrowed from his brother some time before. Charles may have intended to move on from there to a different hiding place, but he was still home when, at about 3 a.m., Captain Day and 6 police officers pulled up at the yellow cottage in a police wagon. Day instructed 3 of the officers to remain with the wagon. Then he took the other 3, including Sergeant O'Coin from the earlier incident, to the gate at the side of the house. By the light of kerosene lanterns, they could see that the gate led to a dark, covered alleyway running past six separate doors, each one the entrance to a one-room apartment in the cottage. Captain Day opened the gate. He and the other officers, along with the civilian bystander who had volunteered to go with them, then stepped along the alley's plank walkway to the first door and knocked. A woman, apparently roused from sleep, came to the door. Day demanded to know which door belonged to the room shared by those men, and the woman seemed to realize immediately whom they meant. "In room number 4," she told them. The five men continued down the walkway to the fourth door in the line. They noticed that it was already slightly ajar. "Open up there," one of the officers shouted. The door swung open to reveal Robert Charles standing in the dim light. He was holding the rifle, aimed directly at Captain Day. Without any hesitation, Charles fired. The bullet struck Day in the chest. According to later testimony, the captain spun around, gave an awful moaning cry, and collapsed dead onto the plank walkway. For almost 15 seconds after the shot, no one moved, all, including Charles himself, apparently incredulous at what had just happened. Then the civilian bolted down the alley and back to the street. "My God!" he shouted. "I think they have killed Captain Day!" But the other patrolmen remained standing in the alley, as if paralyzed by disbelief, until Charles fired a few more bullets into Captain Day's sprawled body, lifted the rifle, and fired another shot that virtually shattered a second policeman's skull. At this, O'Coin and the other surviving patrolmen, Corporal Ernest J. Trenchard, came to their senses and began to return fire. But Charles had by now slammed his door shut and was reloading the Winchester. During the lull in gunfire, the door to the second room on the alley opened. A young black woman, later identified as Annie Kreider, beckoned to the men in the alley.
"Come in, officers, come in here,"
she hissed at them. O'Coin and Trenchard gladly complied. They rushed to the offered refuge just as Charles reopened the door to his room and stepped into the alley. Annie Kreider slammed her own door shut and then blew out her lamp, plunging the room into darkness. For several minutes, nothing happened. Charles began pacing the plank walkway outside, his measured footsteps clearly audible on the creaking boards. He was muttering curses under his breath, ridiculing the policemen through the closed door and daring them to leave their hiding place. But O'Coin and Trenchard didn't move. Out on the street, meanwhile, the three policemen stationed there by Captain Day, incredibly, did nothing. After hearing the shots and the shout of the fleeing civilian volunteer, one of them, Corporal Honore Perrier, told the other two to run around the block to the back of the building to cut off any escape Charles might attempt. But when nothing else happened after many minutes, they returned and consulted with Perrier. Finally, at about 3:30 a.m., a full half hour after the first shots had been heard, one of them walked up to the cottage gate and called out, "Do you need any assistance in there?" But there was no answer, so he returned to his place, and there the officers just waited. About an hour later, they saw a dark figure come up to the end of the alley. It was Charles, and as they watched, he lifted his rifle and took a pot shot at Corporal Perrier. The bullet narrowly missed his head and embedded itself in a pole behind him. At this, the three officers ran away, ostensibly, they later claimed, to find a telephone to call for assistance. Why this had not occurred to them earlier is a mystery. In any case, one of them rang up the station from a nearby pharmacy and reported considerable firing at the 4th Street cottage. Reinforcements were immediately dispatched. Then the three policemen returned to the scene of the shooting, though they maintained a safe distance from the gate at the side of the cottage. At 5 a.m., just as dawn was breaking, O'Coin and Trenchard carefully opened the door to room 2 and peered out into the murkily lit alley. They had heard no movement out there for some time, and when they saw no sign of the gunman, they piled out of the doorway and ran down the alley to the street. Several units of police had by now gathered on the scene. O'Coin and Trenchard told them what had happened, and when they felt they had enough men, they all cautiously approached the gate. Eventually, they felt it was safe to enter the alley. The two dead officers lay just where they had fallen hours earlier. But Charles was nowhere to be seen. And though the police now conducted an extensive search of the cottage and the surrounding neighborhood, they were obviously too late. Robert Charles, with his Winchester rifle and his pistol, was already long gone. By 7 a.m., nearly every police officer in the city of New Orleans was on the scene, along with scores of armed would-be vigilantes from the neighborhood. Police and several white civilians were ransacking the room of the man they now knew as Robert Charles, looking for evidence. Others were scouring the neighborhood for any sign of the man. The scene was chaotic and volatile. When one witness claimed to have seen Charles ducking into a backyard privy, the reaction was swift. In a moment, 100 or more infuriated men had run into the yard, the item reported. Quicker than work could tell, they had torn up the floor of the vault, and a veritable hail of lead was being poured into the dark hole. The outhouse was then pushed off its foundation, and the pit below it was dragged, but the hole yielded only human waste and soiled paper. Meanwhile, the discovery of Charles's cache of migration literature was fueling speculation that he was some kind of fanatical race agitator, intent on evil toward the white man. This revelation only stoked the anger of the crowd and hardened its determination to find him. Soon, alleged sightings of the gunman were sending mobs of vigilantes out into an ever-widening area of the city. According to rumors, Superintendent of Police Gaster wanted that man badly and had allegedly told searchers not to hesitate in shooting the villain if he showed the slightest attempt to fight. By midday, the largest manhunt in the history of New Orleans was turning the city upside down. Trains and ferries were stopped. Citizen volunteers watched all major roads in the parish. Police were conducting floor-by-floor searches in public and private buildings throughout the city, as well as in Kenner, Gretna, and even as far away as Natchez and Vicksburg, Mississippi, where it was said some of Charles's relatives lived. The hunt for the man the Times Democrat was now calling one of the most formidable monsters that has ever been loose upon the community went on for hours, and ultimately for days, but without success. The ease with which Charles had eluded them caused considerable consternation among his would-be captors, and it wasn't long before this frustration was being vented on a more available target, namely the city's black population. On Tuesday, the first day of the fruitless search, a few skirmishes broke out between groups of whites and blacks, mostly in the vicinity of the 4th Street cottage. Police arrested many blacks who appeared to be sympathetic to the missing man, and even one white visitor from New York who merely suggested that Charles may have shot the three policemen in self-defense. At the 6th Precinct Station House, threats to lynch Charles's accomplice forced Superintendent Gaster to move Leonard Pierce to the relative safety of Orleans Parish Prison. But white crowds became increasingly belligerent over the course of the day, until rumors that Charles had been captured in suburban Kenner calmed some of their ire. Even so, by midnight, there were numerous reports of black men and even women being beaten by the roving mobs. By morning, when word spread that Charles had not been captured after all, the violence escalated again. Encouraged by inflammatory editorials in the morning newspapers, in particular a Times Democrat piece that essentially blamed the black race as a class for the crimes of its individual members, gangs of openly armed men raced through the streets of New Orleans, terrorizing any black person they could find. The atmosphere only worsened when the first edition of the afternoon States appeared. An editorial entitled Negro Murderers, written by the newspaper's notoriously racist editor, Henry J. Hearsey, all but called upon the city's white male population to retaliate in kind for what amounted to a secret and widespread black insurrection. "We know not, it seems, what hellish dreams are arising underneath. We know not what schemes of hate or arson or murder and rape are being hatched in the dark depths," Hearsey warned. "We are, and we should realize it, under the regime of the free Negro, in the midst of a dangerous element of servile uprising, not for any real cause, but from the native race hatred of the Negro." Not that many white New Orleanians, frustrated by increasing job competition with blacks, needed much encouragement. On Wednesday night, violence spread throughout the city. A mob of some 2,000 whites formed in Lee Circle at the foot of the towering monument to the Confederate general. In a scene hauntingly reminiscent of W.S. Parkerson's rally against the Hennessy acquittals just 9 years earlier, several orators spoke to the throng, inciting them to outrage, urging them to save the good name of New Orleans by punishing a black population that was clearly sheltering the murderous fiend in their midst. And so again an armed mob surged through the streets of New Orleans, with spectators cheering them on from the sidelines. Again, justice was going to be served, only this time the victims were to be innocent blacks rather than innocent Italians. The mob was, if anything, even more indiscriminate than the one of 1891. Unable to vent its vindictiveness and bloodthirsty vengeance upon Charles, journalist Ida B. Wells later wrote, the mob turned its attention to other colored men who happened to get in the path of its fury. Streetcars were stopped and overturned. Black passengers were taken out and beaten or shot. Negroes fled terror-stricken before the mob, like sparrows before a picnic party, the Times-Democrat reported. The progress of the mob was like a torchlight procession all the way to Washington Avenue. On every side, cries of kill the Negroes, shoot them down, and like expressions were freely used. By 9:30, the mob, now numbering some 3,000 men and boys, had reached the New Parish Prison in the Central Business District, where Leonard Pierce was being held. But they found the doors barricaded and the building protected by a double cordon of armed policemen and sheriff's deputies. The throngs tried to rush the doors, and there were several altercations between rioters and police, and even a few shots fired, but this time the line of blue held fast. The angry men swayed this way and that, the Times-Democrat reported, and their utter impatience in getting at the Negro Pierce seemed to drive them into a state of madness. By 10 p.m., the frustrated crowd had moved on from the prison, breaking into smaller groups that roamed the city in search of prey. One group crossed Canal Street and entered the new Storyville district. The red light district was all excitement, a reporter for the Picayune later wrote. Women, that is, the white women, were out on their stoops and peering over their galleries and through their windows and doors, shouting to the crowd to go on with their work and kill Negroes for them. Saloons, dance halls, and houses of ill fame, at least those catering to a black clientele, were by this time largely shut up tight, but the mob assailed them anyway. Out went the lights and the honky-tonks, the Picayune reported. The music stopped in the dance houses, and the blacks, who were dancing, singing, and gambling, ran in the dark. Some hid under the houses, others sought refuge in outhouses and under cisterns. At the club called Big 25 on Franklin Street, Buddy Bolden was sitting in with Big Bill Payton's band, playing with Payton on accordion, Big Eye Louie Nelson on clarinet and bass, Jib Gibson on guitar, and a few others. According to Nelson, a woman ran in and warned them that a mob was heading into the district, as Storyville had also come to be known. Nelson was tempted to leave that minute, but Payton calmed him down. "Ah, we never had nothing like that in New Orleans yet," Payton said, "and it won't happen tonight." He told the band to just keep playing. But then they started to hear some shooting nearby, and everyone panicked. "Me, I was sitting at the inside end of the bandstand, playing bass," Nelson later recalled. "All them boys flung themselves on me in getting away from the door and out toward the back. The bass was bust to kindling, and I sailed clear across the back of the room, so many of them hit me so hard all at once." The musicians and customers climbed out a back window into the alley behind the club, only to find out that it was already filling with white rioters. So they ran in the other direction. "Me and Bolden and Gibson was together," Nelson continued. "We thought Josie Arlington might let us through her house in Basin Street, but when she saw who we was, she slammed the door, locked it, and started to scream. So we cut on through the lot next door, made it over the fence, and on down Basin. Not one of us had a shirt on him by then, and Bolden had left his watch hanging on the wall near the bandstand. We might have been assassinated, but we was lucky enough to get to a friend's house. We locked ourselves in and barred the doors." The rampage went on all night, in the district, the Vieux-Carré, and any other neighborhoods where blacks might be found. It was clear that the rioters had one simple, ugly intent. The supreme sentiment was to kill Negroes, as the Picayune put it. Every darky they met was ill-treated and shot. And through all of this, the New Orleans Police Department arrested no one. By morning, three blacks had been brutally killed, with six more critically wounded. Around 50 others had received lesser injuries, including 5 whites, 2 of them shot by mistake, and 3 others beaten or shot for merely objecting to the senseless violence. Fearing a second day of mayhem, then-mayor Paul Capdeville, who had been out of town recovering from an illness, returned to the city. He ordered every saloon in the city closed and called for the formation of a force of 500 special volunteer police to quell the violence. By afternoon, he had 3 times that many, including hundreds of the city's most prominent citizens. Business in New Orleans, after all, had come to a virtual halt by now, as huge numbers of workers, black and white, stayed away from their jobs. The riot was even having a negative effect on the city's securities market. Something had to be done. The better element of the white citizens, according to Ida Wells, began to realize that New Orleans in the hands of a mob would not prove a promising investment for Eastern capital. So, the better element began to stir itself, not for the purpose of punishing the brutality against the Negroes who had been beaten, but for the purpose of saving the city's credit. Whatever their motivation, the citizens' force did make progress in heading off the violence. By Thursday night, when the special police were supplemented by an influx of state militiamen, the city seemed more or less under control, but not before 2 more blacks had been killed and 15 others non-fatally shot or beaten. And although a semblance of order now reigned, no one forgot the fact that Robert Charles was still at large, and there was no telling what might happen when that bloodthirsty champion of African supremacy was finally caught. In a small room in the rear annex of 1208 Saratoga Street, just 14 blocks from his home on 4th, Robert Charles was waiting. He had been there, holed up in the single room that constituted the structure's entire second story, for 3 days now, having come directly from the scene of the shootings early Tuesday morning. It was not perhaps the best place for him to find refuge. He was known in the neighborhood as a friend of the Jacksons, the family who rented most of the densely occupied duplex building from its white owner. Any police investigator checking out the gunman's friends and associates would hear about the Jacksons eventually. But Charles's mobility was still limited by his leg wound, and as the owner of the most famous black face in the city of New Orleans, now emblazoned across the front page of every daily newspaper, he didn't have many other options. Nor could he have had any illusions about how this adventure was likely to end. A black man who killed 2 white policemen in the New Orleans of 1900, no matter what the circumstances, would never be allowed to explain himself in court. And so, Robert Charles was preparing to defend himself. He still had his Winchester rifle, and in a first-floor closet under the building's narrow staircase, he had set up a small charcoal furnace. Here, he was melting bits of lead pipe to make bullets. His intent was clear. If he was to die at the hands of a mob or the New Orleans police, he was going to take as many people with him as he could. Charles's vigil came to an end on Friday afternoon when he saw a police patrol wagon pulling slowly into Saratoga Street. Superintendent Gaster had received a tip shortly before noon that day. A black informant had claimed that a family by the name of Jackson, thought to be relatives of the fugitive, was harboring him in their home. A few quiet inquiries had revealed the location of that home as 1208 Saratoga Street, and although this was only one of numerous leads Gaster had received in the days since the shootings, it was a plausible one. So he'd sent one of his best officers, Sergeant Gabriel Porteous, who had been instrumental in turning away the mob at the parish prison on Wednesday, to check it out, accompanied by 3 other men from the second precinct. When he saw the police wagon at about 3 p.m., Charles collected his weapons and retreated into the closet under the stairs on the first floor. With the closet door slightly ajar, he had a clear view of the front door of the annex, which opened onto a courtyard separating the front and back portions of the building. Charles sat there, on the chair he had been using when making bullets, with the loaded Winchester on his lap. In the courtyard outside, Sergeant Porteous and one of his men, Corporal John Lally, were now questioning the main tenant of the place, a black laborer named Silas Jackson. Without preamble, Porteous asked him where his brother Robert Charles was. Jackson, who had just woken from an after-work nap, replied that he did have a brother named Charles Jackson, but that Robert Charles was no relation of his. Porteous, hoping to intimidate the man into revealing what he knew, and Jackson almost certainly had to be aware that the fugitive was hiding in his back annex, insisted again that Charles was his brother, and placed him under arrest. The sergeant then demanded that Jackson let them search the premises. Jackson could do little but agree, and he led them to the door of the annex. Once inside, Porteous caught sight of a water bucket standing on a little table across the room, just outside the closet where Robert Charles was hiding. Claiming to be thirsty, Porteous stepped over to the bucket and grabbed the dipper. Charles didn't hesitate. He thrust the barrel of his rifle through the crack of the open closet door and fired a shot point-blank into Porteous's chest. Then he turned the rifle on Lally and shot the corporal in the gut. Both officers fell to the floor with fatal wounds. As Silas Jackson ran in a panic from the room, Charles gathered up his supply of homemade bullets and carried them, along with the rifle and his Colt revolver, up the stairs to the second-floor room. Once there, he began to kick at the wood and plaster wall that separated the room from its counterpart in the other half of the duplex building. He managed to pound a large hole in the flimsy wall, which he then crawled through into the empty room next door. Now, with access to both sides of the duplex, he would be able to watch the courtyard in front of the annex and the alleyways on either side of it. Clearly, he was preparing to make a last stand, and he was going to make his capture as difficult for the police as possible. Within minutes, scores of white neighbors and passers-by were filling the street in front of the building. The other two policemen who would come with Sergeant Porteous had by now called in the shooting and were awaiting backup. But others were not so cautious. Dozens of white neighbors, apparently thinking that Charles had decamped, were soon flooding into the alleys and courtyard around the back annex. One off-duty police officer, Patrolman Peter Fenney, who lived down the block, entered the ground-floor room and saw Porteous dead and Lally sinking fast. The latter, sitting upright on the floor in a slowly expanding puddle of blood, requested a priest. Feeney ran out to the street to find one, and before long was leading a Father Fitzgerald from a nearby church through the milling crowds and into the ground-floor room. At this point, Robert Charles decided it was time to make his continued presence known. Scanning the crowds in the yard below, he selected a white youth standing near the fence, aimed his Winchester out the back window, and fired. The young man, 19-year-old Arthur Brumfield, was hit in the hip and fell to the ground amid panicked mayhem. While others scrambled to exit the closed yard, Brumfield began crawling toward a stairway leading into the front building. He looked back and apparently saw Charles in the second-story window, still aiming the rifle. "For God's sake, don't shoot!" he allegedly cried, but Charles fired again, this time sending a bullet into the youth's chest that killed him instantly. By now, word of the discovery of Charles's hideout was spreading through the entire city. Police from stations all over uptown New Orleans were arriving on the scene, along with hundreds of armed white civilians drawn from their homes and workplaces. The Special Citizens Police Force was mustered again and quickly dispatched to the scene. Mayor Capdeville, notified of the situation as he enjoyed a Turkish bath at the St. Charles Hotel, realized instantly the great danger the situation posed to the city. He called on the state militia to hurry to Saratoga Street with their two Gatling guns, allegedly with orders to fire into the white mob if their fury degenerated again into widespread violence against innocent blacks. Utter chaos now reigned in the streets around 1208 Saratoga. An estimated 10 to 20,000 people were thronging the neighborhood. Hundreds of men had climbed onto rooftops surrounding the house and were now taking pot shots at the second-story windows of the back annex. Charles, moving back and forth through the hole he'd kicked in the wall, would occasionally appear at one window or another to fire back. Each time, his shot would be met by dozens of answering reports, the bullets shattering the glass panes and shredding the wooden facade of the annex. How many times Charles himself was hit would never be known, but he was taking a heavy toll on his attackers. 7 of them, police and citizens alike, were seriously wounded in these exchanges, with a dozen or more others sustaining lesser wounds. Whatever else they thought they knew about Robert Charles, they now knew for sure that he was an excellent shot. But the standoff was not to go on indefinitely. Captain William King of the Julia Street Fire Patrol, along with a few other men, apparently acting without permission, had managed to sneak into the ground floor room of the annex of 1208, from which the bodies of Porteous and Lally had been removed some time earlier. They found an old horsehair mattress in the room and carried it over to the foot of the stairway leading up to the second floor. Then, while Charles paced across the two rooms above their heads, They poured kerosene on the mattress and set it afire. King doused the flames with water so that the fire would smolder and produce copious amounts of smoke. Then he and the other men retreated from the room. For 5 minutes, the crowds looked on expectantly as black smoke filled first one side and then the other of the two-story annex. But Charles seemed unfazed, still pacing the two rooms and firing from the windows. Finally, however, the stairway of 1208 caught fire. The heat generated by the mounting flames must have been intense, and when fire and smoke began penetrating the roof, many of the spectators wondered if Charles would be burned alive. But then the fugitive appeared at the front door of the far side of the annex, the Winchester leveled at shoulder height, his derby hat pulled low over his eyes. Taken by surprise, no one got off a shot at him as he raced across the courtyard to the front section of the building. Still aiming the rifle ahead of him, he rushed into the ground floor room of 1210, only to find several men lying in wait inside. One of them, a medical student named Charles Noray, a member of the Special Citizens Police, was the first to react. He fired at Robert Charles just as he stepped into the room. Charles fell face first to the floor and was just rolling over to shoot back when Noray and every other man in the room began emptying their firearms into Charles's body. The gunfire didn't stop as dozens of other men, howling in triumph, raced toward the room and discharged their own weapons into the corpse. The orgy of shooting let up only when the last man's last bullet thudded uselessly into the lifeless body. Eager to show their quarry to the crowds outside, several men lifted Charles's corpse and carried it to the front door. They dumped it on the stoop, and then, when it was understood what had happened, a cheer ran through the crowd outside. Several men ran up to the porch and dragged the body into the street. A few fired their own weapons into the corpse. Others kicked or spat at it. Then a policeman carrying a double-barreled shotgun pushed his way through the crowd. It was Corporal Trenchard, the lavishly mustached patrolman who had humiliated himself during the incident at the Yellow Cottage, cowering in a darkened room long after Charles had fled the scene. He had borne the brunt of much scornful criticism since then, but here he felt he could redeem himself.
"Now who says I am a coward?" he crowed.
Then he put the muzzle of his shotgun to Charles's chest and fired both barrels. Content at first to let the mob vent its rage on the corpse, police stepped in when someone brought up a container of kerosene to burn the body. They forced the would-be arsonists back and made room for the patrol wagon to be pulled up. Two officers lifted the body by the arms and legs and flung it roughly into the back of the wagon. The frustrated mob attempted to get at the body again, but police held them off. The patrol wagon pulled away then, Charles's head hanging precariously over the edge of the wagon's bed, as hundreds of screaming, rock-throwing citizens followed in its wake. And so the hideous monster had been punished, but unfortunately, Black New Orleans still had to endure one more night of terror before it was all over. Dissatisfied with the fact that Charles had endured so little physical retribution before he died, white New Orleanians went on another ugly rampage that night. Again, the mobs ran through the streets, ostensibly looking for accomplices, but actually attacking any black person they found on the street. Two more bystanders were killed, and the Lafon School for Black Children, regarded as the best Negro schoolhouse in Louisiana, was burned to the ground. Throughout the night, there were other threats of arson and attempted massacres of black citizens, but thanks to the intervention of the Special Volunteer Police, the bloodshed was not nearly as bad as it had been on Wednesday night. By the time dawn broke on Saturday, the mob's anger was all but spent, and the city was relatively quiet. The weekend papers generally expressed satisfaction at the quick resolution of the Saratoga Street standoff and relief over the end of mob violence in the city. Surprisingly, they also admitted to a certain amount of grudging respect for the bravery of the gunman who had sold his life so dearly. Robert Charles was the boldest, most desperate, and dangerous Negro ever known in Louisiana, the Picayune wrote. Even Henry Hearsay of the States seemed impressed. Never before was such a display of desperate courage on the part of one man witnessed, he wrote. I cannot help feeling for him a sort of admiration, prompted by his wild and ferocious courage. But all of the papers made sure that the proper lesson was drawn from the Robert Charles affair, namely, that any future challenge to white supremacy in Louisiana would be met with the harshest retribution. the days of even moderate racial tolerance in New Orleans were officially over. This new low point in the city's racial atmosphere became increasingly palpable to blacks in the aftermath of the riot. For when the incident had finally played itself out, after the mutilated body of Robert Charles had been buried in an unmarked plot in the city's Potter's Field, and after the post-riot investigations had led to the inevitable conviction of absolutely no one, except for five police officers who were convicted of cowardice and dismissed from the force, the city emerged as an even harsher and more hostile place for its black citizens. Political disenfranchisement and social segregation were now reinforced by a hardened resolve among whites to actively keep the black man down in the century just beginning. This new attitude was perhaps best expressed by one white city official in 1902. "The nigger's all right in his place," the man explained to a reporter for the magazine Outlook. "But when he tries to get out of it, hit him on the head, and next time he'll come in with his hat off." For the musicians in New Orleans' nascent jazz culture, the changing environment would mean more outright suppression of their livelihood, more reform campaigns against the dance halls they played in, more police disruption of their parades and picnics. Most of them had escaped physical harm, but the psychological effects of the riot were to linger on. And at least one musician had lost his life in the violence. Big Eye Louie Nelson's father, a butcher and occasional accordionist, had been killed by a mob in the Vieux Carré on the first night of the major rioting. His body, battered and shot up, was found in a gutter on Decatur Street and was carried to the hospital in the early morning hours of July 26th. "Nobody knew him," Nelson later recalled, "but when they showed him to me, I knew him. It was my daddy. They had snatched him off his meat wagon down at the French Market and killed him. Was I angry about it? Well, sure I was. But what could I do? It just wash away. It all just wash away. Couple of days later, I was back there at 25's playing harder than ever." That's when Nelson learned that to play the new music right, you had to shove in crying wherever you get the chance. But it was one thing to suppress the spirit of self-assertion represented by Robert Charles, and for that matter by jazz itself. Destroying it would be something else entirely. In the years after 1900, in fact, Charles became something of a folk hero among the black citizens of New Orleans. Legends soon grew up around his name, that he had killed 32 policemen, for instance, that he'd shot one officer at a funeral, killing the cop but leaving the priest standing beside him unharmed. Some people even said that Charles had never died in that house on Saratoga Street, that somehow he'd escaped and lived to a ripe old age in hiding. And of course, this last legend was in a sense true. Robert Charles did live on, in a song about his exploits, composed by an unknown hand in the days after his apotheosis. It was played in private all-black gatherings for years thereafter, though rarely in public. According to Jelly Roll Morton, who was just 15 years old at the time, "This song was squashed very easily by the police department, and not only by the department, but by anyone else who heard it, because it was a trouble breeder. So that song never did get very far. I once knew the Robert Charles song, but I found out it was best for me to forget it." Others in the city's black neighborhoods, however, would not forget the song so easily. Chapter 8. Storyville Rising. The lights were what amazed everyone. There were 100 of them, suspended from the ornate tin ceiling like the bright burning stars in Tom Anderson's own private galaxy. "We didn't have no sunglasses in them days," one habitué of the place would later claim, "but you needed them in Anderson's. Hurt my eyes just to walk past at night." It was 1901, opening night of Tom Anderson's monumental new annex in Storyville. Sprawled over the corner of Basin and Custom House Streets, the annex was a palace for the appetites, the most modernly equipped and brilliant bar in the South, and reportedly the first in the nation illuminated entirely by electric lights. Its half-block-long cherry-wood bar, punctuated by polished brass cuspidors and decorated with gilt bas-reliefs in neo-Empire style, ran the length of the building,
backed by 5 huge arched mirrors that multiplied those 100 lights to create a dazzling glow. 12 bartenders manned this ocean liner of a fixture, this virtual bowling alley of beer and whiskey, serving customers who stood 4 deep on the brown and white tiled floor. Opening night was a thing to marvel at, the bar's intrepid manager, Billy Struve, would later recall. Hundreds of people were there, representatives of the big breweries and the wine companies from all over the country. More than 100 cases of champagne were sold, the patrons outbidding each other for their favorite vintages. Before the night was over, everyone was walking in champagne. And there was ample reason for celebration. Storyville, technically open for business since 1898, finally had its linchpin, its headquarters. For patrons approaching the new Tenderloin from the Central Business District or the Vucare, Anderson's Annex would be the first stop they'd come to, the district's gatehouse, as it were, perched tantalizingly aglow on the neighborhood's leading edge. From here, over a bracing glass or two, a sporting man could plan out his entire evening's entertainment, asking advice of the knowledgeable bartenders, or even consulting a blue book, the uncensored, ubiquitously available Baedekers to the district's countless offerings. These guides, helpfully published by Anderson and Struve, a former reporter for the Daily Item who had begun working for Anderson in 1900, were aimed at the man who wants to be a thoroughbred bounder. They contained ads, photos, and descriptions of every one of the better brothels and prostitutes in the 18-block area of Storyville, with each practitioner conveniently identified by race, for example, W for white, C for colored, J for Jewish, and OCT for octoroon. To own a blue book was to have the district at one's fingertips. "Go through this little book," the preface assured readers, "and when you go on a lark, you will know the best places to spend time and money. It puts the stranger on a proper grade or path as to where to go and be secure from hold-ups, race games, and other illegal practices usually worked on the unwise in red light districts. In short, anyone who knows today from yesterday will say that the Blue Book is the right book for the right people." And the right people were in the right place at Anderson's Annex. The big electric sign over the door, spelling out the proprietor's name in bright white letters, told them as much. After all, Tom Anderson, the former Irish Channel snitch, the erstwhile office clerk with the easy manner and the open hand, had already become the dominant figure of the nascent district. Resplendent in a fine suit with an emerald-encrusted pocket watch and diamond-topped cravat pin, he looked like anything but a common saloon keeper. Mr. Anderson had a little white, waxed mustache and looked rather like a banker, one patron admitted. He always wore a white flower in his buttonhole and kept his pants pressed like a boulevardier. And from his command center, amid the glittering lights of Basin Street, he could look out on the new centerpiece of an ever-growing domain, one that besides the annex now included his original Arlington restaurant on Rampart Street, another Rampart Street club for black patrons called the Astoria Club, and a soon-to-be-opened restaurant on Gravier Street called the Stag, whose elegance, the Daily Item would say, was such that Nero himself, in all the attempts he made to make his palaces the finest in the world, never imagined. In addition to these drinking and eating establishments, he also had his interests in Josie Arlington's brothel and in a number of other similar places in the district. The 43-year-old Anderson, in fact, was already being identified in the newspapers as the unofficial mayor of Storyville, a moniker that would stay with him through the rest of his life. But by now, Tom had an official title as well, Representative Anderson. Early in 1900, thanks to his numerous friends in the local ring, Anderson had successfully gotten himself nominated for a seat in the Louisiana General Assembly, representing New Orleans' 4th Ward, the one that encompassed most of the new district. Opposition to his candidacy had been fierce, particularly from the always conservative Daily Picayune. "Mr. Anderson," the paper opined when his nomination became public, "is the owner or conductor of a place on North Rampart Street that bears perhaps the worst reputation of any drinking house in the city." For this reason, the Picayune viewed his nomination with distinct disapproval. "The lawless classes have no right to participate in the making of laws," the paper went on.
for if that responsible duty were turned over to them, they would reverse the positions of good and evil and trample right, justice, virtue, and industry underfoot. If the Fourth Ward had to be represented by a saloon keeper, as the ring claimed when nominating Anderson, it is certain that one could have been found who at least conducted an orderly and decent place, patronized by a respectable class of people. But despite this full-throated opposition from the forces of respectability, and an attempt by the State Democratic Committee to disown the candidate, Anderson went on to win his seat. Sworn in on May 14th, Anderson took office claiming to owe allegiance to no one, not even the ring, and he vowed to support civil service legislation and other reform efforts. But few people took these protestations seriously. By June, the papers were already taking note of the new representative's chumminess with certain saloon influences in Baton Rouge. When in November he made his petition to open up the palatial new establishment on Basin Street, the application sailed through without a hitch. And although he was still having occasional trouble with the more conscientious elements in the police department, including a pesky arrest in March of 1901 for violating the Sunday closing law, a law that he had been elected, some said, expressly to overturn, he was generally prospering in the new open environment of legalized vice. And why should he not prosper? For an entrepreneur like Anderson, the business model of the vice industry was all but failure-proof.